Walks like an animal, talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animal, talking animal. Talks like an animal, must be an animal. Come hear the animals, talking animals, talking animals.
Good morning. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and before I go any further, let me thank Bev Capshaw and Ronnie Elliott, who sat in for me last Wednesday, delivering a terrific version of the show. Today, my guest is Paul Solotara, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone who's written a wide-ranging expose of the dark world of puppy mills in the current edition of the magazine. That's the one with Emma Stone on the cover. Over the years, we've done a number of shows on puppy mills, nefarious operations that relentlessly breed dogs, typically in horrific conditions where the animals live in wire cages, often exposed to illnesses, and even more often exist among nostril-singeing collections of feces and urine. I was really struck by the scope and depth of Paul's piece. It opens describing a puppy mill in North Carolina, sickening scenes aplenty at a site of vast cruelty and evil, and one that was about to be raided by local authorities, representatives of the Humane Society of the United States, veterinarians, and others, totaling some 20 people. From there, Paul takes the reader on a journalistic journey of how puppy mills are flourishing, the relevant laws that are weak, rarely enforced, or in some cases just simply non-existent, some people who operate puppy mills, some people who investigate and seek to shut down puppy mills, and more. We'll discuss much of this as we have time for today when I speak with Paul Solotara in a few moments here on Talking Animals. Later, I'll speak with Joe Capozzi, a staff writer at the Palm Beach Post, and, full disclosure, a friend of mine, who was biking in Big Cypress National Preserve recently when he came upon an astounding scene, a python attacking an alligator. He videotaped the battle with his iPhone, a dramatic video that's since gone viral and become an important document for those who study wildlife in that region. But right now, let's get to Paul and puppy mills with a reminder that I invite you to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj at wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. Let's welcome Paul Solotara to Talking Animals. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Duncan.
Thank you for joining us on Talking Animals.
Pleased to be here, although I feel bereft without any details in my story about a giant snake.
Well, that, I think, will be the next piece, clearly. The snake and the gator. I see it now. But and really, kind of with that in mind, you know, before the puppy mill article, I had read a bunch of your work, and as something of a media junkie, I took note of the range of your pieces, from a poignant and a really highly personal piece about your autistic son to a really what now looks like a very prophetic profile of Trump from 2015. In fact, that I hope we'll maybe have time to circle back to. So I guess a key question at the moment is, why this piece on puppy mills? What drew you into writing about that?
Well, you know, I didn't know terribly much about puppy mills until 3-4 years ago when I happened to stumble onto the Humane Society of the United States and its brilliant president, Wayne Pacelli, who not only furnished me with three remarkable, very brave young undercover investigators who went and worked in a huge pig breeding barn in Wyoming, a revolting dairy operation in upstate New York, a hen laying farm in Iowa, and came back with video, came back with captured sound bites to demonstrate the conditions in the kinds of facilities in which about 99% of the meat we eat in this country is raised. I wrote a long, very widely read piece called In the Belly of the Beast. And when I was done with it, Wayne thanked me and said, "Congratulations, your work is now half done." I said, "What's the other half?" He said, "Well, if you're really going to tell the full story of factory farming in America, then you have to write about dogs, because dogs have become the other huge, major agricultural commodity in America in the last 50 years.
And so he threw down that gauntlet, and apparently he hooked you.
Yeah, well, I didn't have a dog in this fight. We didn't get our first dog until about a year and a half ago. And like anyone late in life who comes to dog love, I went skidding over Niagara Falls and went back to Wayne with renewed fervor and energy. We got a second dog from a Houston rescue group who pulled Cooper, a combination poodle and Bichon, from a kill shelter just a day or so before he would have gone to the room and lost to the world. So, I now have a dog in the fight, two to be exact.
Well, you're sort of answering questions that I thought we may or may not get into later, because I was going to address because the factory farming piece, which you just quickly note too, was as much in some ways, I mean, it was a big step into that world for sure. But one of the things it dealt with, which was, I think, as critical as some of the other elements, was the whole ag-gag laws that are designed, obviously, to prevent people from exposing just what sort of dark world takes place there.
Yeah, and, you know, so they also apply to large dog breeding facilities now in many of the states that have passed these laws, and in big farm states. So just to sort of open the story out, factory farming of dogs took off after the Second World War, when the industrialization, you know, the corporatization of family farming, the buying up and agglomerating of all these small farms into much larger ones, forced a number of small family farmers out of business, in many cases off their land that had been in the family for generations. And the USDA, by way of, you know, sort of throwing breadcrumbs at these guys, told them about this new potential growth industry, which was puppy farming. And so these families, who were typically on fairly small farms, 60 acres and less, simply converted their barns and chicken coops into kennels, in many cases, turned those big, you know, steel drums into cages. And there were small business loans extended to some of these farmers. There were pamphlets distributed by the USDA to encourage them to make the switch over from chickens and hogs to dogs. And, you know, very few of these farmers knew the first thing about animal husbandry when it came to dogs. But nonetheless, you had this mass proliferation of what were then backyard kennels, which, you know, as these things do, grew bigger and bigger, because dogs can have litters every 5.5 months. So it wasn't uncommon for folks to have 4 or 5 dogs, then 20, then 50, and suddenly they've got 100 and they're overwhelmed. And once these operations outstrip the ability of the family or the couple that's running the kennel, then the animals really begin to suffer. And what I walked into is a landscape of widespread suffering.
And so, yeah, I guess one of my initial questions, in fact, was giving the historical understanding that you had, that you just sort of outlined for us, and given the earlier story you had done, and Wayne saying, hey, okay, your work's half done here, pal, now let's get to the dogs. To what extent did you anticipate going into this project just how dark, even the depraved, this universe would be?
Well, it would have been hard for it to have been much worse than what I encountered in beef raising operations, veal auctions.
Sure.
You know.
But you might not necessarily expect that in something that initially, before you do step into that world, seems more innocent, more innocuous maybe somehow than a beef or veal operation.
Yeah, that innocence doesn't last very long.
Yeah, for sure.
Reams and reams of video files of undercover footage taken by the Humane Society, taken by another superb investigative organization called CAPS, Companion Animal Protection Society, based in Rhode Island. And, you know, it's the same thing over and over. It's dogs, adult breed dogs, packed into cages, typically made of wire, typically with wire flooring, and kept in outbuildings that either grant them no access to the outdoors, or in these filthy dog runs, which are just basically extensions of the cages they spend their entire lives in, but which extend outside by a couple of feet. And, you know, in some parallel universe, they call that a dog run.
Yeah.
And so these animals are raised in the most toxic kinds of conditions. You know, if there are, per the HSUS, 10,000 such places in America, there's no way to know that every single one of these operations, about a fifth of which are licensed by the federal government, are all as toxic and inhumane as the ones I've either entered or seen extensive video, undercover video of. But there's no reason for them to be better than that, because it is absolutely legal to raise dogs in grossly inhumane conditions. According to the Animal Welfare Act, which is the only law on the books governing the care, feeding, and housing of commercial breed dogs, they can spend their entire lives in a wire cage barely bigger than their body. So if, for instance, the dog is a beagle, he or she can and probably will, if she's a breed dog, spend her entire life in a box the size of a dishwasher.
Yeah.
Never get out, except when she gives birth and goes into a slightly larger enclosure called a whelping box, which she shares with 5 or 6 or 7 puppies.
Okay. So, well, one of the key things I did want to discuss with you, which you sort of brought us to, you know, is that there are a number of ways to become obviously disheartened over the course of reading this article, whether it's just the total absence of humanity, much less compassion than the people who preside over these puppy mill operations, or just the general sense of helplessness projected over how to curtail the activity through laws. And as with so many of areas of animal welfare, when it comes to properly protecting animals in the puppy mill arena, it just seems like the legislation is either weak, toothless, non-enforced, or non-existent.
Yeah, so there are a number of states that have, number of farming states that have either weak or non-existent regulatory statutes on the books, Arkansas being one of them, that govern how you treat commercial dogs, how you house them. There are other states that have passed or strengthened their existing dog laws. I'm thinking of Missouri, I'm thinking of Pennsylvania and Ohio. But then you have these very small state Department of Agriculture staffs, you know, inspector and investigative staffs that are charged with not only inspecting and regulating, that is to say, writing out fines, bringing potentially criminal investigations against the most egregious breeders. But, you know, they're also charged with inspecting and regulating every USDA-licensed operation in which animals are being housed. So that includes zoos, it includes circuses, some roadside menageries, which, by the way, will be my next story, animal research laboratories, aquarium. So they're horribly overextended in these places. And, of course, farming operations. So, you know, to expect these skeleton staffs to be able to effectively ride herd on, you know, just enormous and, for the most part, undercover industry is, you know, is wishful thinking at best. And the reason I wrote this story was to attack the industry or attack the worst aspects of this industry from the other end, namely the consumer education. You know, I, as a young reporter, was covering the streets of New York during the worst of the crack epidemic in New York, 89, 90, 91, 92. And the way crack was essentially eliminated or enormously downsized as a public health menace was not the so-called war on drugs, in which everyone in the ghetto was rounded up, but rather something called the Big Brother effect. Big Brother effect was something that happened when kids saw the older members in their crew or the guys on the corner start getting high on their own supply, wasting away, dying, and or going to jail. That is what essentially sidelined crack as the horrific pandemic that, you know, blew up homelessness, blew up foster care placements, blew up violent crime in cities and towns. And so effectively it was consumer driven, much the same way as, you know, the vast campaign to educate the public about the, you know, the lethal effects of tobacco has hugely curtailed the number of smokers and, you know, the kind of cultural impact that big tobacco has in America. The only way I think you ever begin to undercut this industry is by choking off its blood supply. And that is by informing consumers, many of them as you possibly can, as to where these dogs come from. Pet store dogs, online website dogs, overwhelmingly come from these places. And it's very, very easy to walk into one of these stores, see, I don't know, 150 gorgeous, you know, 2 and 3 month old puppies, most of them purebred, but many of them now these so-called designer breeds, Labradoodles, Bichi Poos, and want to save one. You know, hold them in your arms, see that their eyes are running with gunk, see that, you know, they're having trouble breathing, that they walk strangely when you put them down, but nonetheless fall in love at first sight and want to take that dog home, want to save that dog. Well, it's a noble impulse that is connected to a much less noble reality, which is, you know, every time you open a crate, another puppy mill puppy will replace it.
Yeah.
And that mother, that father, are condemned to yet another breed cycle.
Let me let folks know, this is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss. If you just tuned in, my guest is Paul Solotaroff, a contributing editor at Rolling Stone, who's written a major expose on puppy mills that appears in the current issue of the magazine. If you'd like to ask Paul a question or offer a comment at the moment, please call 813-239-9663, email dj at wmnf.org, or text 813-433-0885. Yeah, it's interesting, Paul, because as you talk about the noble intentions, and there's a scene in your piece where that happens, where one dog is presented online as this cute puppy, like, hey, wouldn't you like to take this guy or girl home? And then the lady meets the dog. It's nothing like the dog online, but still noble intentions or otherwise, takes the dog home and it's got all kinds of medical issues. And then you report that friends of hers had again tried to responding to that cute puppy in the picture online, tried to get that particular dog, which also never existed at any time the breeders met up with the customers. So it's just scam, bait and switch, and all kinds of things. Even those are the good things that happen.
Yeah, so she had the relative good fortune, did Kristen Aiken, whose story is particularly wrenching. Kristen, lovely woman in St. Louis, mother of three, had lost her two young children, 2 and 5, to a very rare immunological disorder, was still grieving the loss of those children and the loss of their dog, who died shortly thereafter, and went looking for a dog online, like so many unsuspecting consumers, she came upon a website that purported to be loving, humane, and local, selling the exact dog she wanted, a golden doodle. And on impulse, she reached out to this this breeder, a notorious outfit in Missouri called Cornerstone Farms, and offered to come straight over and pick up the dog. She never actually spoke to anybody there. It was all done by text. Your first strong signal that you're not dealing with a reputable breeder.
Mm-hmm.
She got another text saying that there was no need for her to come over. Breeder would be driving up to St. Louis the next day with a dog for another family and would be happy to meet her in a public parking lot. And this is the exact scenario in which so many online dog transactions go down. You ask to go visit the kennel, you ask to go meet the dog, no, can't do it. Or there are 5 different excuses why it's inconvenient for the breeder. So you agree to meet them in a public place, usually the parking lot at a mall. And what comes out of that car, what comes out of that van, doesn't look a damn thing like the dog that you thought you bought online.
Mm-hmm.
So in Kristen's case, instead of getting a 4-month-old, adorable golden doodle wearing a bright pink bow, what she got was a cowering and scab-covered adult, well over a year old, who was sick in numerous and very expensive ways. And being a huge-hearted woman, she said, well, I must have this dog. I must save this dog. Took the dog home and brought her to the vet. And thousands of dollars later, got confirmation that this was, in fact, an adult dog, that the dog's legs and paws were covered with scabs. There were all sorts of ear infections and horrific diarrhea. And, Kristen had the time, the money, and the patience to endure that dog's recovery, to finance that dog's recovery. Problem is that, our shelters, which are full to bursting in America, we've got millions and millions of dogs at any one point, something like 12 million dogs in shelters and rescue facilities in this country. Many of them are pet store purchases who prove too sick, too damaged genetically, or whose behaviors were too challenging for the people who bought them and fell in love with them to keep. And so they get dumped on the street or they get brought to kill shelters. And we put down something like 2 million dogs a year. And we have this enormous overbreeding and oversupply of dogs in commercial breeding operations, somewhere between 2 and 3 million dogs come out of these puppy mills every year. Well, in much of Europe, this is unheard of. In England, for instance, you need a license to breed even one dog. Street dog population is virtually non-existent. I think in the entire country, or constellation of countries, that is Great Britain, exactly 5,000 dogs were put down last year. Mm. So there is this direct connection between the proliferation of these sick, genetically damaged dogs and the vast number of beautiful dogs that we euthanize every year in this country.
And again, with the sort of staggering numbers and the money to be made, one of the things that would seem like, a bit of a surprising anomaly within your piece is that a big corporate entity, the Hunt Corporation, is now defunct. But as a lot of people have discussed online, Facebook, elsewhere, is it in fact defunct or just operating under a new name?
Well, it's very nebulous,
mm-hmm,
and difficult to pin down. That facility is now called Choice Puppies.
Yeah.
And according to Missouri documents I obtained, Choice Puppies is actually owned, or appears to be owned, by the Hunt Corporation. But no one at Choice Puppies / Hunt would return dozens of phone calls I put into them or emails to its new owner. So there was simply no way to ascertain. I did visit their facility in Goodman on a Saturday, but it was closed and appeared to be open only a couple of days a week. But they have an enormous property there. And, you know, this was the Hunt Corporation, a particularly notorious broker. So it's useful to explain to readers who don't know what brokers do, that when the dog business really took off and suddenly there were pet stores in every neighborhood and every city of any size in America, you couldn't simply furnish those stores with, you know, what the traffic allowed from, you know, folks who had litters, you know, a half hour outside the city. Now you needed lots of dogs and you needed designer dogs. So pet stores really began to kind of flourish and become corporatized in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, just as America got increasingly affluent. And suddenly, you know, having a dog wasn't enough. Now you needed a designer dog. You needed some affirmation of just how rare and noble a creature you were. And so these brokers sprung up in Missouri and Iowa and Indiana, to buy dogs from the local breeders in those states, consolidate these puppies in one big place, and have the capital to buy these big trucks, these 18-wheelers or vans, to ship them all over the country, you know, 1 and 2 day drives. Problem is that these dogs were ripped from their moms at 6, 7, 8 weeks of age. 8 would be late, because the magic hour in pet stores is, oh, this puppy is exactly 8 weeks old. So if that puppy is 8 weeks old, as the store claims, then it was probably taken from mom at 6 or 7 weeks, way before its immune system was mature, way before it had all the nutrients it needed to be strong enough and resilient enough to endure 1 and 2 day truck rides in these tractor trailers with dozens of sick, coughing, tearing, other puppies to whom they had little or no immunity. And so undercover footage taken by CAPS investigator showed what the conditions on the floor at the Hunt Corporation were like, where there were just hundreds of sick dogs, sick puppies in their infirmary. And that undercover footage and report further demonstrated that, you know, a day or two after being medicated, after, you know, being inoculated, they were then put on these tractor trailers and driven, you know, 1,200 miles to New York, or driven 1,800 miles to Los Angeles. And so what you wind up with are dogs, many of whom are in terribly, terribly poor health when they get off that truck. And, you know, it then becomes the store's responsibility for trying to save those dogs while at the same time selling them. And there's all sorts of undercover footage taken by cats of petland stores in the Midwest at which, you know, dogs are dropping, you know, small puppies, terribly sick with pneumonia, with other respiratory ailments, are dying. You know, it's simply part of the cost of doing business. And one of the things that Hunt became notorious for was for burying upwards of 1,000 pounds of dead puppies a year out behind its plant in Missouri, and being put on notice by the state that, no, that's too much for us to tolerate.
I don't know where you draw that line, but yeah.
Well, Missouri draws it at 1,000 pounds.
Oh, I see. Okay, literally. Okay, I gotcha.
But per year.
Yeah.
But, yeah, the laws are similarly lax in other states. So, for instance, in, I believe, Arkansas, one breeder was forced to put down, or chose to put down, 1,200 dogs rather than treat them for a minor disease. Another set of breeders in Pennsylvania simply shot to death their 80 breed dogs rather than have them treated.
Yeah.
Or, I believe, fleas and ticks. And this, at the time, was perfectly legal. So
yeah.
This kind of callousness and nonchalance is, or again, it certainly has been, part for the course.
Ugh. Well, we have just a few minutes left. This is Talking Animals. I'm Duncan Strauss, and I'm speaking with the Rolling Stone contributing editor, Paul Solotaroff, whose latest piece for the magazine explores the dark, horrible world of puppy mills. We have, like I said, just a couple minutes or so left, but you are invited to join the conversation by calling 813-239-9663, emailing dj@wmnf.org, or texting 813-433-0885. There are some emails that have come in I hope to get to. But one thing I wanted to get to among my questions is, as one measure of the breadth of your piece, that the reporting really travels far and wide, is the section you devote to a guy named Wes Eden, who's certainly sounds like an outlier. Maybe you could describe a little bit about what Eden does and where that sort of places him amongst the denizens of the puppy mill world.
Right. So there's this whole constellation of people who are trying to save puppy mill dogs, from the huge animal welfare organizations like the Humane Society, like the ASPCA, like PETA, you know, a dozen much smaller, but nonetheless robust organizations around the country. And then you have people who say, you know, raids are not enough, or raids, while useful at getting publicity and media coverage, are effective at spreading the word. They don't actually save the lives of the dogs who are bred, then bought, and or traded within the industry from one breeder to another. So these folks, this particular class of rescue groups, go to puppy mill auction houses, and they buy the breed dogs who, as Wes Eden, this extraordinary young man in North Texas, who does this, described to me, these auction sites are where breeders sell each other their trash. And so he goes there with money raised on his Facebook page. He has an organization called the Lone Star Dog Ranch near McKinney, Texas. And most of the year, it's a boarding barn for loved and permanently homed animals. But he and his family have taken upon themselves to raise many, many tens of thousands of dollars, go drive 11 hours to an auction house called Southwest Auctions in the southwest corner of Missouri, and buy as many of these adult breed dogs, in his case, mostly bulldogs, bring them home, fix them up medically, which is enormously expensive. These are dogs who have spent their entire 7, 8, 9 years churning out litter after litter after litter, and many of them are in horrific shape. But once those dogs are rescued medically, they are then rehabbed spiritually, taught to become a dog again, or become a dog for the first time in their lives, and then adopted out to a long waiting list of willing families who are really ready to roll up their sleeves and have a special needs dog and make it happy for the rest of its life. And it's an extraordinary operation, by no means the only one. There are a number of really noble enterprises in the Midwest, in Chicago. There's some back east. I ran into a rescuer who had driven all the way from the Northeast to rescue a smaller breed. But this is controversial because, you know, in effect, Wes, by bringing $60,000 to buy 20 French bulldogs and save their lives, is effectively, providing the seed money to buy more breed stock. So the very breeders who are churning out these dogs now have fresh cash with which to go and replenish their breed stock.
Yeah.
But he makes a very powerful argument. It's about those dogs he's saving. I saw some of those dogs, and, you know, you'd have to have a very hard heart to resent him for what he's doing.
But again, like I say, it's a measure of the scope of your reporting and the piece that resulted, because even that has a very sort of complex element to it. Just that one guy, and like you say, there's others that do what Wes Eden does. But just as you say, what he's doing seems noble, and if you see the dogs he's sparing, I mean, how could you really argue? And yet, HSUS folks and others that are on the trying to eradicate or just reduce the whole puppy mill madness think, okay, well, this is just fueling and funding more dogs. So, I mean, anyway, it's a very complex story, but it's a really important one. This has been Paul Solotaroff. Again, his new piece, depending on if you're reading it online or in the magazine, it's The Dog Factory, it's Inside the Puppy Mills, whatever it's called, absolutely you should read it if you haven't had a chance. It is available online. Paul, thank you very much for making the time to join us today on Talking Animals. We will look forward to the piece on roadside menageries, and since we're out of time, and actually a little bit over time, I guess I'll just say quickly, I was hoping to come back to your Trump piece, but geez, I mean, you certainly made it clear in retrospect, it was a big caveat, like, take this guy seriously. He is not bleeping around. And sure enough. So,
yeah. Well, we all have learned to regret our initial, what would you call it, mirth?
But I guess what I'm saying
is, was on us.
Yeah, well, the joke was on us, but even then you said, hey, you know, there was some cautionary tale elements to that piece, and that was in like September of 2015. So anyway, we just have to sort of see what happens next in light of some of the most recent revelations and battles journalistically over those revelations, et cetera. So, Paul, we'll look forward to your next piece. Thank you again for joining us today on Talking Animals.
My great pleasure, Duncan.
In a few minutes, I'll speak briefly with Joe Capozzi about the striking battle between a python and an alligator he witnessed in Big Cypress National Preserve, recorded on his iPhone. That video has since gone viral and has implications for wildlife experts there. Right now, it's time to step into the Comedy Corner with a piece that has direct relevance to Joe Capozzi's story, or at least starts out that way. Here's Joe Zimmerman with a portion of a piece called Pet Snakes in today's Comedy Corner. on Talking Animals.
Apparently snakes have taken over the Everglades, giant exotic anacondas and Burmese pythons. They don't belong there. Apparently people bought baby snakes. They didn't realize they grow to be up to 25 feet long. So at some point in that growth, they were like, hey, Mrs. Slithersby got scary. She just took a horse-sized dump. And our horse is missing. Have you seen Pony Danza? Maybe we should put her outside. She'd be happy in the Everglades, nice swamp, lots of old people.
That was Joe Zimmerman with a portion of his piece called Pet Snakes, taken from his album Smiling at Wolves. Now on to my conversation with Joe Capozzi and the eye-popping python gator battle he witnessed while biking in Big Cypress National Preserve and captured it on video with his iPhone. Let's welcome Joe Capozzi to Talking Animals. Good morning, Joe.
Good morning, Duncan. How are you?
Good. Welcome to the show, although I was thinking this morning, it's not technically your first time, because you did one time a few years ago speak with Brian May on the show by phone. So I guess it's sort of your second appearance in a way.
Yeah, I grew up loving Queen, and it was a thrill to talk to Brian May, the guitar god.
Yeah. So set the scene a bit for what took place at Big Cypress that day. What were you doing out there, and how did you kind of come across the scene?
Well, it was just I had a vacation time I wanted to use from work, and my wife gave me the blessing to disappear into Big Cypress for 2 days. I put the bike on the back of the car, and I went down and stayed at a little cabin in the kind of on the outskirts of the swamp, and just did a lot of bike riding. And on the morning of the second day there, December 21st, I drove to Loop Road, and environmental wildlife folks may know Loop Road. It goes off Tamiami Trail, 20 miles south into the heart of Big Cypress. And I drove like a mile or two to a parking area, got on the bike. It was 9:30 in the morning, and I'm just pedaling along, and I'm all alone. And it's, if you've been down there, you know it's beautiful, and there's birds everywhere, and alligators sunning themselves on the side of the road. And I'm pedaling along, and once in a while you hear like a splash, and that's usually an alligator off in the weeds, and it hears my bike coming, and it takes off into the swamp. There were a lot of other gators that didn't budge. They were enjoying themselves. It was a sunny, warmer than normal for December. So at one point, probably 5 miles in, I hear like a series of splashes, like one after the other. So I'm thinking, oh, maybe a family of alligators all jumped in at the same time together. And I was still pedaling, like cruising real slow, and I just turned to the right. And I saw, it was like a surreal image, because I saw a tail and the white pale belly of an alligator rising up out of the water. It was almost like if the thing had jumped in from the air, and then you put the video in reverse, and it was coming out of the water.
Oh, wow.
And that struck me as like, man, that's not normal. I don't think he's moving against his own will. And I skidded to a stop, and then the next thing I see is it was like a stack of tires. And it was the coiled muscle of the snake with the giraffe-like splotches. And probably 30 to 40 seconds in, I realized that that was a python engaged in a wrestling match with the alligator.
And Joe, either then or at some point later, did you have a sense of how long at its full length that python was?
When I went back into cell phone service like an hour or two later, back at the place where I was staying, it was a photographer, Clyde Butcher's photo studio. He has rental units on his property. That's where I stayed. And I went into the gallery and showed it to his guides, and they looked at it, and they thought it could have been 15 feet long. Mm. And then I've heard other experts that have since seen the video, they think it might be more in the 12 to 14 foot range.
Still, a lot of python.
The head was so big. And it was just like the gator wasn't, I mean, it was moving around, and the splashing that I heard was the gator's tail.
Yeah.
Like trying to hit the thing in the head, and it would just keep hitting the water.
Well, and also what I guess should be noted is, you know, friends of yours, and I am one, know that you often cruise around wherever you are, at home or on this kind of trip, taking what end up being really exquisite photos with your iPhone. It's just sort of a passion or a hobby. And so once you heard that splashing, was it just sort of instinct or, hey, this is kind of why I'm out here in a way? So you just whipped out your phone even without knowing necessarily what you would be looking at?
Exactly. I mean, when I'm on these rides, and I'll take the bike out on weekends in Palm Beach County, places like River Bend Parks, Cypress Creek Natural Area, and you're all alone out there, and it's beautiful. It's a good way to recharge the batteries. And you always see stuff, and you never know what you're going to see. Like one morning, I was kind of close to where you live up in Cypress Creek, and the sun had just come up, and I saw like a bunch of deer, like 20 feet from me, and they stopped and looked at me and took off into the wild. And it was, you know, 20 seconds of like a little moment where you see something up close in the wild that you normally wouldn't expect to see.
Sure.
And it's like that wherever you go, and especially with in South Florida with alligators. And I always respectfully keep my distance from them.
Yeah.
They're beautiful animals. They're beautiful creatures, especially when you see them, you know, kind of up close.
Because I remember, in fact, when you were on this trip and you were just posting kind of more regular things at that point on Facebook, and then there was this thing like, hey, hang on, I just saw something here, and, you know, when I get back in cell phone or whatever, I'm going to try to put this video up. So I guess you kind of knew you had witnessed and recorded something extraordinary, even if you didn't maybe have the full measure of it at that moment.
That's what you just said is a perfect way to describe my reaction. I knew it was unusual and neat, but it didn't really sink into, like, when, you know, once I had a little pocket of cell phone service, and I think for the first thing I did, I might have tweeted a photo of this snake on the water, and you could see the bottom of the snake coiled up a few feet under the water, and it was wrapped around something, and it was the alligator, but you couldn't see the gator. And I tweeted that, and then I, you know, rode my bike for another 90 minutes. When I got back to cell phone service, my phone had lit up. People were retweeting it. One of the editors at the paper saw it and left a voicemail. You got to get that video. Download that. We got to get that on our website. And once I talked to experts, they were like, you know, it's sad, but this happens a lot, and it's rare to witness it in public. And, you know, one of the expert I talked to said that when I videotaped, it's not like that was the first time that happened and I happened to see it. This is probably happening all the time. And I just happened to come by that one time all alone in the wild and saw that.
Yeah, because, I mean, it certainly, as I've noted a few times, has gone viral in places that you might expect and places that you wouldn't expect, like the Weather Channel have played it and whatever. So it's really become kind of its own phenomenon. But maybe, in light of what you just said, maybe I had misunderstood this, but I thought the impact for people who do study wildlife in those regions, that it was quite striking that what you had captured, they found quite important and illuminating in some ways.
Yeah, their point was that it's rare to see it for like a human being to witness that.
Oh, I see.
Wild,
yeah.
Let alone shoot video, get it on video. Like,
right.
They know it happens all the time. They found, because, you know, python is, as you know, pythons are invasive species, and there's a real concern that they're going to change the ecosystem. They've been known to swallow alligator, deer, endangered Key Largo wood rat, and they're trying to get rid of them. So they found alligators in them before.
Yeah.
And they know that this happens all the time. So the video, and we did some subsequent stories, and the video going viral, we're hoping that it helps educate the public on, you know, it's one thing to look at this like, oh, that's neat, there's a snake and a alligator wrestling, but it speaks to a larger problem of invasive species in South Florida that are threatening the ecosystem.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, you couldn't get more vivid evidence of kind of what's gone wrong when the gator who belongs there is on the losing end of a battle with the python who doesn't belong there.
Exactly.
Yeah. Well, Joe, thanks for filling us in, and thanks for the amazing footage. And again, for people who are listening, I did post it on Facebook yesterday, I think it was. But you know, it's easy to search for and find, and you can also search for and find Joe's article, kind of further accounting for what sort of blow by blow happened that day. So, anyways, Joe, thanks again for joining us on Talking Animals.
Thanks for having me, Duncan.
All right, take care.
Take care.
Coming up at 11 on WNF, it's Rob Lori and Radioactivity. Rolling into the new Now Concerts, a full 2 hours of interviews, phone calls, news, and more with contributions from members of the stellar WNF staff, including, of course, Everyday Ethics with Craig Kopp. Meanwhile, as a prize for naming that animal tune, I'll be offering a Talking Animals t-shirt. Right now, we don't have too much time for animal news and announcements, but I do want to acknowledge two passings, animal passings, one high profile, one not so much. First of all, Tilikum, the killer whale involved in the deaths of three people over the years, including SeaWorld trainer Don Brachot, has died, and that happened about 4 or 5 days ago. So, anyways, a tough life for Tilikum, and living at various places, and of course at the center of the documentary Blackfish, and we've talked a lot about Blackfish, SeaWorld, Tilikum, and others on this show. So anyway, a sad passing for Tilikum. And also a lower profile side passing for those of us who care about the band The Eels, and I play them periodically on this show and certainly on music shows, but they have a lot of animal related songs, and not coincidentally the main guy, Mark Oliver Everett E, is an animal nut of some level, and sadly his beloved Basset Hound Shepherd mix Bobby Jr. died, considered the sixth eel, and was always at Eels recording sessions and appeared in many of their videos, most notably The Look That You Gave That Guy with Padma Lakshmi, and I guess in the last year there was a photo of Leonard Cohen with Bobby Jr., among others. So anyways, a great sweet dog, and meant a lot to E and the Eels, so it meant a lot to those of us who love the Eels. So rest in peace, Bobby Jr. I'm Duncan Strasser, you're listening to Talking Animals, where the show website is talkinganimals.net. It's time to proceed to name that animal tune. You know what, I think we'll actually hold that off for next week, and just tell you that on next week's show, my guests will be Catherine Michon and Bruce Cameron, the husband-wife team who wrote the forthcoming film A Dog's Purpose, based on Cameron's book, starring Dennis Quaid and directed by Lassie Hallström. It's a major movie, and it's all about dogs. So tune in for that next Wednesday on Talking Animals on WMNF Tampa. Stay tuned for the NPR News and Rob Lohr after that with Radioactivity. Thanks.